A History of Ancient Sparta, Lecture 2, Geography and Origins.
So, where exactly is Sparta? And how did Sparta come to be? Our focus in this lecture will be on the geography and the origins of Sparta. Geography first. Ancient Sparta was composed of two of the richest river valleys in Greece. Greece is, of course, a mountainous country and land that is fit for growing grain is at a premium and always has been at a premium. And the valley of the river Eurotas, extending down from Arcadia in central Greece, or in the central Peloponnese, down to the Laconian Gulf, is flanked on both sides by surprisingly tall mountains. To the west is Mount Tegidos, which extends down in a long massif, finally to Cape Matapan, and that is 2,404 meters tall and looms over Sparta. Sparta is, in fact, if you go there, in a spectacular location. Mount Tegidos is snow-capped for much of the year, in cold years for all of the year, and it is, what, 2,000 feet or more higher than any of the Appalachians, than Mount Washington, for instance. And the rise from the Spartan Plain to Mount Tegidos, which is very abrupt and very steep, makes it all the more spectacular. On the other side, on the eastern side, is Mount Parnon, which winds up at Cape Malea and at the island of Kythera. The Eurotas Valley is the Spartan homeland, and that is where Sparta had its beginnings. But the origins of Sparta as a distinctive state, a state with institutions strikingly different than any other polis in Greece, arises in large part from the Spartan conquest sometime between 700 and 550, a gradual process, actually, to some extent over that time period, of the adjoining valley to the west. It is not easy, I can testify, to get from the valley of the Eurotas over Mount Tegidos to that adjoining valley, the valley of Messenia, the Pamisos River Valley, the leading city of which is now Kalamata, the home of Kalamata Olives, as a matter of fact, which may be familiar. But the conquest of Messenia and the Helotization of the residents of Messenia was what gave Sparta its unique geographical extent as a polis and was the source of much of its power. The whole region depended on the Mediterranean triad, as it's called, of olives, grapes, and wheat. This from by archaeological evidence well before Sparta itself was established. You can grow grain, as I said, effectively in the valleys. The grapes and olives do well on the lower hillsides. The Spartans also raised livestock, or the Helots raised livestock more accurately for the Spartans, and the upper slopes of Mount Tegidos were filled in antiquity with game, particularly wild boars, which the Spartans hunted with great enthusiasm, though they weren't above taking rabbits and hares either, and indeed hunting for obvious reasons in a military culture was something which the Spartans valued highly. Also, the lower Peloponnese is far enough south that you can grow two grain crops a year, which was something which was very helpful to the Spartans. The climate is pretty hot. The record high temperature in the summer in Sparta is somewhere around 110 Fahrenheit in the mid lower 40s centigrade. An ordinary day centigrade would be something like 20 to 35 or in Fahrenheit 70 to 90. And it gets cold in the winter too. The coldest on record is about minus 7 centigrade, somewhere around 20 Fahrenheit, and an ordinary day would be between 5 and 15, or between 40 and 60 Fahrenheit. A friendly region for human life, all told, and it was inhabited in prehistoric times by a group of people who Herodotus terms the Pelasgians. They live not only in Laconia, but throughout what we think of as Greece. And they, interestingly enough, were evidently not speakers of any Indo-European language. Nobody knows what language they did speak, but they did leave a legacy in some divine names and some place names, some of which, in any case, are recognizable by the NTH diphthong, as in, for instance, Corinth, which is a pre-Greek name, or, as we'll see, the name Hyacinthos, the origin of our flower name Hyacinth, and also the focus of a major cult in Sparta itself. When exactly the Indo-European speakers came is not certain. Sometime after 2000, evidently, the original inhabitants remained, and there's all kinds of speculation about the interface between the two, much of it having to do with a transition from chthonic earth goddesses, earth spirits, to the Olympian pantheon of predominantly sky gods. The Indo-Europeans evidently succeeded in their homeland, which is somewhere in what is now the Ukraine or southern Russia, north of the Caucasus, in domesticating the horse, which by all appearances gave them a leg up on chariot warfare and made them militarily dominant over many potential neighbors. That may or may not have been part of the impetus for their spread, but most people seem to think that it was. In any case, Indo-European speakers in prehistoric times came to form at least an overclass over the original Pelasgian inhabitants. Sparta was influenced strongly and was aware that it had been influenced strongly by the culture of Minoan Crete. The Spartans spoke of themselves as having, in many respects, what they thought of as Cretan institutions. Minoan Crete was, in fact, the first European civilization. That is a vexatious issue in several senses. What defines a civilization? What sets a civilization apart from other sorts of culture? But by pretty much any plausible definition of civilization, Minoan Crete made the grade. It was literate, although the literacy of Crete itself poses some problems. Their first script was hieroglyphic. They then moved on to a script called Linear A, which has yet to be deciphered to this day, but was evidently not the written form of an Indo-European language either. Finally, they moved to what's called Linear B, which was also employed on the Greek mainland, and that is, in fact, a form of Greek. Crete was a maritime culture predominantly, on the basis of its artwork. Again, we don't have really very much decodable literary information about Crete, but architecture and art survive, and they suggest a cheerful, pleasant culture. The art's actually very engaging. Lots of sea creatures, women wearing big dresses, bare-breasted with little, I don't know what you would call them. What would you call them? Bustier. With little bustier or jackets. The men ordinarily wearing elaborately embroidered breech clouts. Again, very cheerful, brightly colored art in all sorts of varieties. One of the most striking things about Crete is, so far as can be ascertained from looking at the artwork, the prominence of women and evidently the worship of a major goddess figure in Crete, and the unusual prominence of women in Sparta. Think of Helen of Troy, among others, who was, of course, originally Helen of Sparta. That, too, may reflect some sort of Cretan legacy in the Sparta of historic times. The immediate predecessors, though, of the Spartans in Laconia itself and on the Greek mainland were the Mycenaeans, or Mycenaean culture, so called because of the spectacular ruins at Mycenae, which is in the northern Peloponnese, still a very impressive and extensive palace complex with huge walls composed of rocks, which are many tons in weight, so much so, so impressive that the later Greeks termed the stoneworks of the Mycenaean age as cyclopean, the idea being that only someone as big and strong as a cyclops could possibly have moved stones of that size. And there are cyclopean ruins and Mycenaean citadels all over Greece. Mycenae is the most impressive, but there are lots of other ones which are impressive as well. At Tiryns, which is 10 miles or so from Mycenae, it's surprising that they're so close. A smaller one at Lerna, which is also nearby. Thebes has Mycenaean ruins. There's Nestor's Palace at Pylos over in Messenia on the other side of the Peloponnese, at Gla, all over. The world of Mycenaean times is the world of Homer, more or less. Not that Homer lived in Mycenaean times. He lived several centuries later and is writing about the glorious ancestral tales that still live in oral memory about a time which was richer and grander, and in fact that's literally true, by a considerable margin than Homer's own. The Mycenae of Agamemnon can still be seen, and indeed, it was discovered in the late 19th century by a German archaeologist by the name of Heinrich Schliemann, who was a devout believer in the historicity of the Trojan War. He first discovered Troy itself near the Hellespont, the boundary between Asia and Europe in what is now Turkey, and then transferred his efforts to Mycenae in hopes of finding the very palace of Agamemnon, which he thought he did. There are around Mycenae shaft graves, basically deep pits dug in the ground, and then surviving and very spectacular, a series of tholos graves, which a tholos is beehive. They are beehive-shaped, but about 40 feet tall, about 40 feet across, and just immense. Those, because they could be seen to some degree from above ground, had all been robbed. But in the shaft graves, Schliemann found all sorts of gold work and artwork, including what he took himself to be the very death mask of Agamemnon, which is solid gold and which can be seen to this very day. It's in fact too old to be the death mask of Agamemnon, but whoever's mask it was a very prosperous person, and not only with gold masks, but also with gold jewelry and all kinds of other very, very high quality metalwork. This clearly was a culture of some real prosperity and also engaged in pretty extensive trade. It seemed to have been what is called a command economy. There was an aristocracy, a Greek-speaking aristocracy, since they left accounts, though no literature, written in Linear B, which has been deciphered and turns out to be an early form of Greek, lording it over the countryside, gathering and distributing surplus, and so on. There was also a Mycenaean settlement at Sparta, not actually on the site of current or classical Sparta, but rather about 5 miles away or so, on the other side of the river Eurotas, the eastern side of the river Eurotas, well up the foothills of Mount Parnon. It's a spectacular site, not so much spectacular ruins, but the site itself. But all of the Mycenaean sites, for reasons which are still unclear, more or less catastrophically collapsed around the year 1200. And this, what exactly happened, is rather a mystery. 1200 is, by the way, close to the date of the Trojan War, insofar as that was a historical event, and insofar as that can be ascertained. But it wasn't just Troy that fell. There's evidence of burning and collapse at all of these splendid Mycenaean palaces, and even, in fact, as far away as Egypt, there are contemporaneous references to ferocious fights in the Nile Delta against a group of marauders whom, from an Egyptian perspective, were the sea peoples. And where they came from and who they were, nobody knows for certain. The Hittite Empire in Asia Minor collapsed at that time as well, and not so much in Egypt, but in the lands to the north, the incursion of the Sea Peoples, or whatever happened, inaugurated a real Dark Age, in comparison with which the Dark Ages of Europe after the Roman Empire and before the rise of the medieval world were very bright indeed. So much so in the 1100s and 1000s that archaeological remains in Laconia, in the Eurotas Valley, in the area around Sparta, suggest that there was something like a 90% plus depopulation. And indeed, for a while there, it looks like there was no population at all, which is really surprising considering the agricultural richness and potential of the area. If it was, in fact, some sort of successful invasion, it was genocidally effective in the long run, which seems a little bit implausible. Ordinarily, conquerors don't seek genocide. Ordinarily, conquerors, at least at that time, sought to gain control and exploit the existing population, which raises the suggestion, I've only seen this raised tangentially and occasionally, that there may have been something else going on as well. One possibility is an unrecorded plague, and that, I must say, to me seems more plausible than it would have had I not seen, and people don't seem to notice this, and it's striking to me for sure, in my lifetime, the demise of two major species of plants, and know about the demise of another one right before my time. The American chestnut is no more. The American elm is now virtually extinct, with perhaps 1% of the population that it had 45 years ago, 50 years ago. And as we speak, dogwoods are dying out, and ashes are dying out as well. I think we underestimate the vulnerability of biological populations to new threats from disease. In any case, the collapse was massive, and Laconia was more or less open to newcomers when, sometime around 950, they evidently came, and came in numbers. That's not to say that there was no Mycenaean population left. There may have been. But the dominant group in Laconia changed. This brings up a kind of a vexatious issue. The Spartans themselves told two tales about their own origins in the region. They did not claim to have been there absolutely forever. The first is, especially with regard to their ruling families, the myth of the return of the Heraclids. The descendants of Hercules, supposedly, the children of Hercules, had at one time been dominant in the Peloponnese. They left, but they returned. This was clearly when we first have actual Spartan records in the guise of the poetry of Tyrtaeus about 650. He mentions prominently that the Spartan royal houses are descended from Hercules. That's one aspect of it. The other aspect of the Spartan tale about themselves is what in later times was termed the Dorian invasions. There were three major dialect groupings of ancient Greek. Ionian, which was in the Ionian Islands in the Aegean, and some parts of the mainland of what is now Turkey, on the Aegean coast, and also Attica, Attic Greek, which is what, if you learn ancient Greek, you will predominantly learn as also a variant of Ionian Greek, and indeed the Athenians thought of themselves as closely connected with the Ionians throughout antiquity. There's also Aeolian Greek a little bit further north, and then there is Dorian Greek, which is what the Spartans spoke. One difference, a readily perceptible difference, is lots of Ionic names end in "-es," as in, for example, Socrates. The corresponding ending for Doric Greek would be "-os," as in Leonidas or Leotikidas. That's one of a whole variety of groups. I am not myself conversant enough with ancient Greek to be able to tell how an Ionian would have sounded to a Dorian, but it is clear that they sounded comprehensible but significantly different. Traditionally, English translators of Ionic Attic works, which included Dorian speakers, translated them in Scots as opposed to English. Some Americans have translated them as if they were Texans, and something like that must have been how it felt. There were also an array of cultural differences that were associated with these various groups, and you can get a sense of the difference between Dorians and Ionians, to some extent, if you think of Doric columns and Ionic columns. Doric columns are unadorned with a plain pedestal. Ionic columns have little curlicues on the end. And Ionians tended to think of Dorians as rude and unsophisticated, and Dorians tended to think of Ionians as over-sophisticated and elitist and unappealing in that grounds. This sort of cultural division, of course, recurs in many different contexts over the years. But at any rate, the Spartans were Dorians, and very self-consciously Dorians, and they thought of themselves as having come to Sparta as part of the Dorian invasion, if you want to call it that. Actually, as far as I can tell, the evidence for there having been such a thing is pretty good, but people are hesitant nowadays to talk about it much because German classical scholars of two or three generations ago absolutely loved the Diorians, loved the Dorians, and thought of themselves as being affiliated in some sense magically with the Dorians, and the whole idea got tied up somehow in notions of Aryan supremacy, so much so that folks are very reluctant to maintain that there ever was such a thing as a Dorian invasion. The Spartans, though, certainly thought so. Doris itself, the place where the Dorians were supposed to have come from, is north of the Gulf of Corinth, outside the Peloponnese, in central Greece. And the Spartans, in one of their major festivals, the Carnia, carried makeshift rafts, little model rafts, in a procession to commemorate their own cultural memory, or cultural fabrication, perhaps, but I would presume actual cultural memory, of crossing the Gulf of Corinth into the Peloponnese on rafts. It meant a good deal to them. There are considerable cultural continuities between various Dorian groups as well. There were three Dorian tribes, which were common not only to the Spartans, but to other Dorian groups, the Hylles, the Dimanes, and the Pamphyloi. And the Dorians also celebrated a variety of common festivals, which other Greeks did not celebrate, the Carnia, about which we'll speak more, prominent among them. Once they got to Sparta, it was a while before Sparta consolidated into a city, and indeed, in some sense, it never entirely did. There's an interesting and very famous passage in Thucydides at the beginning of his History of the Peloponnesian War, in which he comments on this. He says, "I suppose that if Sparta were to become desolate, and only the temples and the foundations of the public buildings were left," which is effectively the situation now, if indeed that, "that as time went on, there would be a strong disposition with posterity to refuse to accept her fame as a true exponent of her power." In other words, if you only saw the ruins of Sparta, there's no way you'd believe that Sparta was ever as powerful as, in fact, Sparta was. "And yet," says Thucydides, "the Spartans occupy 2/5 of the Peloponnesus and lead the whole, not to speak of their numerous allies outside. Still, as the city is neither built in a compact form nor adorned with magnificent temples and public edifices, but composed of villages after the old fashion of Hellas or Greece, there would be an impression of inadequacy." And indeed, Sparta, in the days of its greatest power, was composed, the city of Sparta itself consisted of 4 semi-combined villages by the name, as it happens, of Pitana, Mesoa, Limnai, and Kynosura, or Dog's Tail. One was the headquarters of one of the branches of the Spartan kingship, the Agaiads and had the Acropolis of Sparta, such as it is. It's not as impressive by any means as the Acropolis of Athens, but in fact, it's more impressive than you would be led by many accounts of it to imagine. And that was where their central temple was to Athena Poliachos. The other major early temple in Sparta itself was to an indigenous goddess named Orthia, whom they assimilated with Artemis. And that was in the realm which was the home base of the Eurypontid branch of the kingship, and specifically in Kunashura. Sparta began to take off as a polis, though, after those four cities were incorporated into a single polity. And when they moved down the road about 5 miles to incorporate as well the village of Amyclae, which was where there was another major temple complex, this one devoted to Hyacinthus. And then, finally, the full consolidation of Sparta as a major power arose after the conquest of the Pamisos Valley over Mount Taygetus to the west, supposedly during the kingship of Theopompus, or so the Spartan poet Tyrtaeus suggests, sometime around 700. The problem with these early dates in Sparta is that there are no contemporary records at all. We only have records from 50 years to a century or more later, and Greek dates are a mess altogether because each city dated on the basis of leading officials in just that city, and there was no common numerical date for the whole region. So chronology is very, very difficult to establish, all the more so because the Mycenaean script, Linear B, during the Dark Ages, fell completely out of use, and the Greeks became illiterate again and remained illiterate during the whole period of the initial rise of Sparta, and only regained literacy in improved guise about 750, the time of Homer, when they invented working from Phoenician models, which did not have vowels, the Greek alphabet, which does, and so invented the first effective alphabet ever.
This ends Lecture 2. If you borrowed this course from a public library and would like your own copy of the course guide for future reference, call Recorded Books at 1-800-636-3399, and we'll send you a free copy. A shipping charge will apply.